everybody, and welcome back to the Wrestling Archives Podcast. I'm your co-host, Tim Hackman.
And I'm your co-host, Rich Sigwald.
Thanks for being here with us. We're always delighted to be in the studio and talk with you. We hope you caught our recent interview with the Greek god, Papadon. That was a fun guy to talk to. We had a good time. He is a talker for sure.
He is a talker, and I think he's become a fan of ours. He joined our roundtable group on Facebook this week. So if you see a very Greek-looking name posting in there, that's him. You know, say hi to him, cheer him on. Yeah. You know,
don't call him Little Caesar. He doesn't like that.
No, or Papa John either. Don't go the Papa John route either.
And don't slap your leg while you're wrestling him.
Jesus.
He's got some thoughts.
Jesus, no.
We also have a WrestleMania 40 preview coming up for you here real soon, just in time for that show. We're excited, as always, to see the big event. And we got a request from a longtime listener, Nick, for an early 90s Royal Rumble, so we'll throw that in the queue as well. Thanks for that request, Nick. You can always find us on the interwebs at WrestlingArchives.com. You can find our email address there. You can hit us up on social media, send us your requests. If you have a show you want us to look at, you have a performer you want us to sort of do some sort of digging into, we're always happy to get those and to fulfill those where we can. So
absolutely. Nick, we thought you were dead or something, man. We're so happy to have finally heard from you again. It's great to have you back. It was nice chatting with you the other night. So thank you for showing back up.
Yeah, we appreciate it. But we've got a great one for you today. We are getting into the thick of the Monday Night War era. We were talking about the King of the Ring from 1998, and before you ask, yes, it's that one. I'm not going to elaborate at the moment. You know which one I'm talking about. It's coming to you from June 28th, 1998, the Civic Arena in Pittsburgh, PA. Attendance on this show is 17,087. Pay-per-view buys of 385,000 or so. With a tagline, "Off with their heads," and some cover art with a guillotine on it. And there's an animated guillotine on the preview. There's a lot of violence implied in this particular King of the Ring.
Yeah.
And not just implied, I'd say.
No, it's not implied. It comes right at you. This is a interesting snippet of a show, and it is actually a landmark in the Monday Night Wars. It is the thick of it, is the prime. It is the heart of the Monday Night Wars. WCW and Nitro, with Nitro and Monday Night Raw, going at it. And now from, let me look at this ratings chart here, it looks like from basically June of 1996 through April of 1998, Nitro dominated every week. All right, and then starting in late April, you know, Raw started to pull ahead, and that's partially because Stone Cold Steve Austin finally got over, the Mr. McMahon character connected, and they made a real, real consolidated heel out of him instead of having that attention spread out across, you know, the NWO. And then you have also, like, The Undertaker is still chugging along. The Rock is becoming a name. And, you know, the DX is pissing people off. The Nation of Domination is still there rocking it out. So you have some stuff happening. But then this King of the Ring comes along and is apeshit banana pants of a show. And after that...
Is that an official designation?
I believe so. I think that is actually what Vince McMahon actually wanted the tagline for this show to be.
Ape shit banana pants.
Ape shit banana pants. After this Monday night Raw wins all but 6 weeks of the ratings war until the WCW buyout by Vince. And if you look at the ratings tables, they're not even close anymore. They are not. There's one week here that I see that Raw pulled a 7.2 while Nitro pulled a 3.1.
Jesus.
Right. It's not even close anymore. They're doubling the ratings on WCW for the most part, you know. And the Finger Poke of Doom is coming up soon on this, on Nitro and stuff. And you know, it's just not good. And so the Nitro following this event was a match with Canyon versus Horus, Little Dragon versus Eddie Guerrero, the Giant defeating two Japanese guys that came over with Ultimo Dragon, Lex Luger and Sting versus Jim Neidhart and a British Bulldog. By this point, all of those guys are kind of old news. You know, Saturn versus Reese, Vampiro versus Brad Armstrong. Now, I want to watch that match. I might have to pull that one up just because I love Vampiro and I love Brad Armstrong. You know, you have Alex Wright, who's trying to be a heel, and Disco Inferno versus two more Japanese guys that probably no one had heard of. Ultimo Dragon versus Dean Malenko goes to a countout. And then, like, you have Chris Benoit and Steve McMichael versus Harlem Heat. And then Goldberg versus Glacier. Fucking Glacier. Are you kidding me?
What are you saying here, Rich? You're saying they weren't putting their best product forward in 98 there?
Hulk Hogan's not even on the show. Are you kidding me? Yeah. Scott Hall and Nash aren't even on the show. So, yeah. Nitro isn't got much, you know. And this is Goldberg starting to heat up, too. And it's still, it doesn't meet the chaos that is Monday Night Raw.
Well, yeah. And if you watch this King of the Ring, we definitely encourage you to watch it. You can see this is a product that is firing on all cylinders. They are really finding their groove in this kind of attitude era. The cast of characters is here and pretty much fully formed. It's like when you're watching an old sitcom, you know, and like the first season or two, it's a little rough around the edges and like some of the original actors are in. And then by like the third season, they get like all the various replacements in that needed to be there that became like part of the classic cast. And that's kind of like where we are here. The previous class had moved out and the teenagers were whatever they were just really riding high. And Vince is all over this, special, obviously. And it's a, you know, you have to sort of reckon with his place now in the WWE catalog. And it's always going to be one of those things that every show we watch from this era and before where he's present, you're going to have to feel like, oh, there's that guy.
But maybe not all of it is kayfabe.
Maybe not all of it's kayfabe. Yeah. But you have, but again, you can't deny that character and that sort of big boss, corporate scumbag, like worked, you know, and right. it got over.
It's kind of the thing that our buddy Mark Ouellette talked about, how your boss replaced the evil Russians in wrestling bad guys. And, you know, we're making it sound like this show was just like the fairy tale blessing grace, like the clarity that just ended the Monday Night Wars. But the thing is that the show had a lot of problems coming into it, and it's a freaking miracle that it happened. So first of all, before the show started, they sat down and realized that the show was underwritten and was probably about 30 minutes too short, and already the runtime of the show is only 2.5 hours. So suddenly you have people that have paid $30, $40 for a pay-per-view that's about to only be 2 hours long. And so this is the reason why we have a long segment of Vince McMahon and his goons, Pat Patterson and Jerry Briscoe, in the ring with Sable, and the ass slap heard around the world. And you have Paul Bearer that comes out and just cuts a random promo that is excellent, but there's no real need for it. The story is already set up and told. And then they also shoehorn two matches into this event. That were not advertised whatsoever, and the crowd doesn't react to them because there's no story behind them. There's no heat coming into the matches whatsoever, and people just go, okay, fine. Yeah, I mean, there is some fun stuff that leads in. There's this like long video promo too that leads into the show that probably got extended a little bit. And this is the era that Freddie Blassie beautifully narrates all of these video montages that open up the shows. And so it's a highlight of the show. And then also it reminds us that this is the time period where Kane is using like the throat kazoo thing to talk. And I don't think a lot of people remember that Kane actually did that when he first came around, but Paul Bearer wasn't talking for him. He would hold this, I will kill you, Undertaker, you left me for dead, kind of like stuff.
I didn't remember that either. I'm like, what the hell is going on?
Yeah.
Yeah. That video intro is pure fire. Like it's cut together masterfully. Like if you were on the fence about whether or not you wanted to watch this show and you watch that video promo, you're like, holy shit, I'm going to buy this twice. Like it's really, I was wired.
Yeah. And the other disaster that was set up for this show too was that Stone Cold Steve Austin had injured his arm about a week prior at a house show. And the bruise got infected, apparently. He developed a staph infection in a bruise somehow. And just the night before this event, he was running a 104 fever and was in the hospital. On top of that, The Undertaker had broken his ankle. Suddenly, they're coming into this pay-per-view, a half hour short, and their two main event stars are looking no good to go. And so suddenly they're a half hour short and they know that Stone Cold and The Undertaker are going to show up, but they don't know how much they're actually going to be able to do and how long they're going to be able to work.
Yeah. And Undertaker, you can definitely see hobbling throughout the show. And Jim Ross talks about Stone Cold's arm fungus staph infection during that match later on. So yeah, not good. JR and Jerry the King are on the mic. Michael Cole is on interviews. The Fink is in the ring as usual. So we got, again, sort of that classic 90s lineup on the microphone. All of our buddies over there, Hugo and Carlos on Spanish commentary. Let's see, they're joined by China and Triple H at various points on commentary. Our buddy Mike Chioda is in the ring as a ref for along with
frequently, yeah.
Yeah, Earl Hebner and Timmy White, who just passed away this past year. So good lineup in and out of the ring. But yeah, so the first match out of the gate is Kai and Tai, which if you don't remember them, and we wouldn't blame you, was Funaki and Mens Tioa, is that how you pronounce that name? And Dick Togo. And they are facing the Headbangers, Mosh and Thrasher, who have Taka Michinoku on their side. So this is one of the add-on matches, I assume, right?
Yes, this match was tacked on at the last minute.
I'm shocked.
And, it's a decent match, despite the fact that, one of the Headbangers actually never gets tagged into the match.
We liked Taka Michinoku the last time we saw him on one of these shows.
Oh, he's impressive as hell.
That dude can work. Yeah.
He carries his whole match. Even though, I like the Headbangers, but Taka Michinoku carries this match. And, and Funaki gives us a nice Ric Flair, Greg Valentine face bump that looks fun and retro.
Yeah, no, this is actually a solid match. Michinoku gets his Michinoku driver, which is a signature move for the win. I think he pins Funaki, maybe, to get that one.
Yeah, I think so.
I love Dick Togo because his name looks like Dick Togo.
Yeah, yeah. It's my favorite carryout.
Yeah.
Dick Togo.
The worst carryout.
Yeah.
So that out of the way, we get that in-ring segment that you mentioned, and Vince and Pat Patterson and Gerald Briscoe come out, and then Sable comes out too. And so Vince is kind of going on and on about, well, so first Sable comes out for no apparent reason.
Except for boobies.
Yeah, except for her boobies, and Patterson smacks her on the ass as she's climbing out of the ring and gets a pretty solid slap in the face. I don't know. It's just,
and in the commentary, JR slips up and kind of hints that Patterson's actually gay, which he is. So that was kind of funny. And the King drops this great line that's like, I got a lot of, or no, JR drops it. I'm sorry. I got a lot of buddies in Oklahoma that would marry her dog just to be a part of her family. That got me laughing pretty good.
That's a pretty good one. That's a pretty good one. Yeah, I was wondering why Patterson was smacking her on the ass. I'm like, that's out of character. But whatever. So then Vince gets up there and he's insulting the audience. He's talking about them being disappointments to their parents and I don't know. It's whatever. It is what it is. It's a thing
I literally wrote in my note, the Vince segment feels like a time filler. The 6-man tag was added last minute, and now this. What is happening with this show? Now, this was before I started really doing any research. I watched the show first before I started digging.
Yeah.
But we do get a Vladimir sighting at this moment, too. We can see him ringside, which is exciting. So he made the trip from Manhattan all the way to Pittsburgh for some reason.
That guy never missed a show.
No.
He's something else. So, have you watched that documentary yet? I didn't.
I have. It is excellent.
I need to
watch
it.
Please sit down and watch it. It is great.
I need to quit messing around, get my life priorities in order.
Yeah. Always. You don't need your job.
I know. What the hell? So with that filler out of the way, we actually sort of get to the King of the Ring. Now, the first round of the King of the Rings have already taken place before this special starts, which is a little bit different from past King of the Rings that we've seen. So already, let me find the thing here. The first round, Rock defeated Vader, Triple H defeated X-Pac, Owen Hart defeated Scorpio, Dan Severn defeated D'Lo Brown. Ken Shamrock defeated Kama Mustafa. Mark Henry defeated Terry Funk. Blows my mind that Terry Funk is still working in WWE at this point. Yeah. Jeff Jarrett defeated Farouk. And Mark Marrow defeated Steve Blackman. And then the quarterfinals were also on TV. The Rock beat the Triple H. The Triple H. I feel like I sound like my grandmother.
You're old now, man.
Yeah.
You are old.
The Edge. Dan Severn defeated Owen Hart by submission in 3 minutes, by the way.
Yeah.
Ken Shamrock pinned Mark Henry, and Jeff Jarrett defeated Mark Marrow in the question or in the match that probably the least number of people were asking for. So
should note that the next year and the following year, King of the Ring, they have the final eight on the pay-per-view to make sure that they fill time.
yeah they could have saved like two of these, right? Like two of these quarterfinal brackets.
Yeah,
like
they could have gotten all four of them in.
Yeah,
no problem.
They were all the longest of those quarterfinals was The Rock and Triple H at 8 minutes. The others were 3 minutes, 4.5 and 4.5 minutes.
Yeah.
So that leaves us for this one, The Rock and Dan Severn, and then Ken Shamrock and Jeff Jarrett for the semifinals. So that's where we're starting here. Ken Shamrock versus Jeff Jarrett is first. And if there was ever a mismatch of styles, it's these two guys.
Yeah. Jeff Jarrett is accompanied by Tennessee Lee, who used to be Colonel Parker in WCW. And Colonel Parker promptly gets fired about a month after this and goes back to WCW. Which was not a good look for him. And this is kind of where a storyline that we see kind of thrown into the show last minute shows up, and that is the NWA Invasion. That is a storyline that Jim Cornette has shoehorned into WWE at this point, or WWF, I guess. And Jarrett had just been kicked out of the NWA faction and has gone back to his Double J Jeff Jarrett persona, country music guy.
Interesting.
Yeah. And Ken Shamrock is so over. He comes out to a huge pop.
That guy, man. I freaking love that guy. We've talked about this before. But, you know, so you have Jeff Jarrett on the one hand, who's very, he's very old school, but he's also still a little bit of the kind of like cartoonish, sort of over the top, you know. And then you have Ken Shamrock, who is definitely the new breed, you know, just bare minimal trunks and boots, just pure aggression and anger.
And it's real.
Yeah, it like really is.
He's 100% real. He's fighting under his real name. He's showing up as a, and fighting like a real person and just going at it. And they note that Ken Shamrock earlier broke Vader's nose in five places. I don't know how a nose gets broken in five places. That's kind of impressive. But anybody that can fuck up Vader that bad, right on.
Yeah.
Right on.
I'd say anybody that could even inflict a moderate amount of pain on Vader would be is a tough guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's not much action here. Shamrock just about breaks Jeff's damn ankle off and gets the win.
He almost breaks his own neck on that Hurricanrana. He lands on the top of his head. Apparently Jim Ross said in an interview that they were very concerned about Shamrock being able to continue the rest of the night at this point because they saw how he landed. But apparently he was okay enough to keep going.
Good to know. Yeah, he comes up limping a little bit at the end of the match, but it doesn't seem to play in any later, so I don't know. Maybe he just gave himself a little bit of a stinger there. So that's semifinal number one. Did I miss any promos in between the next one?
Ken Shamrock gets intercepted by a baby Michael Cole ringside on the way out. And Shamrock basically just says, I'm going to whip the winner's ass. That's all he basically says. And then they move on.
Man, a few words that Ken Shamrock.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And I was, you know, coming out of the UFC, it was like, and he was in the UFC when it was still very much in development as a sport, you know, and like you didn't have all these guys who were like the judo champions and it wasn't all that like rolling around on the mat and stuff. It was just to an extent, some just really big, scary dudes trying to kill each other. Like Dan Severn, for example.
Yeah. Jesus, this guy's scary.
Oh my God. So he's up next. This is another semifinal. So The Rock is here with Mark Henry and The Godfather, who then get sort of summarily tossed from ringside versus Dan the Beast Severn. So I wrote that Severn looks like someone looked up the definition of man in all capital letters and then just made a man out of it. Like he's got like jet black hair. He's got a mustache that should have its own dressing room. He just has this like permanent scowl. He's barely wearing an outfit. He's wearing like a gray sweatshirt warm up with the sides slit open, basically.
Yeah.
Just like the only thing that can fit over his massive physique.
This dude is just a big old mother. He's my God. And we met him at one of those fan fest things out in Millersville here. And he was a big son of a bitch. Jesus. And scary looking. But apparently he is like the nicest dude ever and like the most professional of professional wrestlers you would ever meet. But like he just looks like a square peg trying to go in a round hole here. His style doesn't fit the WWF style of professional wrestling. Yeah. He looks like an NWA guy, and clear he is. He does mat wrestling. He likes to work technical. But, you know, The Rock and him still put on kind of a decent match. Apparently, they were upset about Dan Severn getting pinned in this match because it made him look weak in Japan. And WWF was just like, who cares? Why should we care about that?
Yeah. So it's fascinating, actually, to see him next to Ken Shamrock because they both sort of came out of UFC at the same time. They were both hugely successful in UFC. Different sort of skill sets, you know. Ken Shamrock was a striker and sort of a judo guy. Dan Severn was a much more of a standard, wrestling guy. But you know, Ken Shamrock was able to sort of adapt and make his personality come out, or maybe he just had a personality that was more geared towards pro wrestling. But Dan Severn was always, like you said, kind of quiet, kind of intense. You know, looked scary, could do like legit stuff, but just didn't have that way to connect with the fans. I can't remember. We watched, I think I sent it to you, or maybe you sent it to me, the videos of Dan Severn demonstrating like a real German suplex, like as a way to incapacitate an opponent.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
He takes one of those like 150, 200 pound punching bags or whatever. and just basically fucking suplexes it straight over his head, like over and over again, like directly into the mat. That would like break someone's neck in half.
Interestingly, though, JR informs us that Dan Severn was an industrial arts teacher, which I can see him being a tech ed teacher, but at the same time, like, I'm not buying that. Like, what was those movies with like Tom Berenger and then eventually what's his name, the principal?
Yeah, the substitute. The
substitute. I picture like a situation like that. Like,
yeah,
I just teach tech ed, and then hostages show up, and I suplex the shit out of them.
And I take my wood chisels to the rest of them.
Right. Also, this match is also kind of the start of D'Lo Brown's gimmick of wearing the chest protector that he is supposedly wearing because he was kayfabe injured by Dan Severn with a torn pectoral, and so he had to start wearing a chest protector to protect his chest and that muscle so it could heal, and he starts using it as a weapon for his frog splash. It is one of the stupidest gimmicks, and D'Lo Brown actually kind of blames that, along with the incident with Draws, for killing his WWF career.
Fascinating. No, it is really dumb. So D'Lo comes out and interferes. Frog splashes Severn while the ref's not looking, and The Rock gets the win. It's a pretty quick win. There's a really nice ringside promo from The Rock after being late 90s Rock. It's a classic one.
Michael Cole intercepts The Rock on the way out of from the ring, and The Rock delivers the line, "Before you reach any peak or valley, The Rock is going to make sure you hit rock bottom first."
Nice.
It doesn't really make sense.
No.
But it's a nice line.
But it sounds good, right?
It's very poetic.
He was so smooth and so cool in this era, you know? Like,
yeah,
coming out of the Nation and then sort of coming into his own thing. Like, there will never be that Rock again, I think. I'm glad to see him back on TV, but, like, that guy's gone.
No, this is right after he had taken over control of the Nation domination from Farouk. So that whole heat thing is over, and The Rock is now, sky's the limit for him at this point.
Next up on the card is Too Much, and if you have forgotten them, that's okay. That's Brian Christopher, a.k.a. Christopher Lawler, right? Jerry King's Jerry's son. Kid. And Scott Taylor versus Al Snow and Head, which, again, if you don't remember, Head is an actual mannequin head with the words, Head was, "Help Me" was written on Al Snow's head. Head was just a head.
Yep.
And there's a nice little video package recapping Al and the Head making their way sort of back to the WWF. It's very goofy. They announce a special guest referee, and it turns out it's Jerry the King Lawler. It's very fortuitous. He's definitely not on Al Snow's side.
Yeah, what's hilarious about that is that before they even announce that, JR starts screaming that they need a referee because there isn't one out here. Like it's almost oversold. Like it's like, "There's no referee. There's no referee. Someone needs to get out here and referee." And then suddenly they play Lawler's music and he gets up and he reveals a ref shirt and dumb.
Yeah. There's some all right action here. Al Snow is a solid worker.
This is a stupid match. And Al Snow on that wrestler's documentary actually specifically talks about this match and how he failed to campaign for himself enough to get the writing crew to put him over in this match. That this match was the turning point and the downfall of his WWF on screen career. He turned into an incredible trainer and was like one of the reasons why they had like a whole new generation of talent coming out was because of his training and him on Tough Enough and stuff like that. But he felt that he should have campaigned harder for himself and gone over in this match. And I agree, the finish of this match is stupid. It makes no sense. And he's the best talent in this match, and it's goddamn shame.
Yeah, Brian breaks out a bottle of Head and Shoulders shampoo and hits Head in the head with it.
And then shoves it into the neck hole of the head.
And then pins the head.
And pins it because you can't pin a head because you need to pin the shoulders.
That's right.
to the mat. And so that's why he needed the bottle of Head and Shoulders shampoo. Mm. It is stupid and the worst product placement you'll ever see in your life. Just to say that, like, the two biggest notes that I made in this were, there's a sign that says, "Go to hell, Carlos," whoever Carlos is, go to hell. And then there's another sign that just says, "D's nuts."
Nice.
You got it.
Yeah. Nailed it.
Yeah.
No notes. Perfect.
Yeah.
There's some good signs throughout this match, throughout this special, actually.
Yeah.
All right. Moving right along. We've got X-Pac with China versus Owen Hart. Is this not a King of the Ring? No, this is
the other match that they booked at the last minute to fill time. And they're like, and the only way they tried to sell it was like, this is a rematch of their match from 1994. Thanks.
What? You know, that classic one that you all remember so well.
Yeah. I mean, it was an incredible match in 1994. And this match is also excellent.
Yeah, it's really good.
It's overbooked at the end.
And that's funny. I wrote, this is what I wrote down as soon as this match started. I said, this has a lot of potential if it doesn't get overbooked. That's what I wrote down.
Yeah. I wrote, this could be a banger, a mess of a match with an overbooked finish.
Yeah.
And then there was some sort of botch from the top rope that left Owen bleeding. And looks like he nearly lost his eye. Like, it missed his eye by like a centimeter, it looked like.
Jesus.
Yeah.
That was ugly. I was having a hard time figuring exactly what happened there. But Owen's looking amazing. He's in black, and he's just looking pissed the entire time.
Yeah.
X-Pac is looking lean and mean. That guy can really move, you know, like, these guys are just both, like, really, really good. I read this is a tough match. They're not pulling any punches. Mark Henry gets involved at the end and splashes X-Pac, and then Vader comes out and hauls off on Mark Henry. Again, I'm not entirely sure why. I assume it calls back to something that we missed on Monday Night Raw, right?
Yeah, probably.
And then, and that's the end.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so another short match. Everything's been short. Like, yeah. You would think they would tell them, like, take up a little more time. Go a full 10 minutes, not just 8.5. Like, come on. So.
Yeah, stretch it out. Yeah, so X-Pac gets the win there, if I didn't say that part. So next up, though, this is a real highlight, and even if it's a filler, Paul Bearer comes out and sort of recounts a recent beating at the hands of The Undertaker, and he talks about going to the emergency room. They, you know, they play the footage of the beating, and then and talks about going to the emergency room and the stitches and having the stitches taken out, and he talks about, with every stitch, dead man, I damned you to hell. He's talking, oh man, he's so pissed, and he's like sweating, and like
he's legit hurt here too. He got hurt in that vignette that they filmed at the house, and that's where Undertaker also got hurt. They both like broke their ankles. Undertaker stepped weird on something and broke his ankle. And in the segment that they show, you can see the Undertaker basically throwing down a China hutch on top of that, that fell down and crushed Bearer's ankle. They're both Ouch. Legit hurt. And so Bearer comes out, and the only thing you can see, though, when Bearer comes out, he's walking down the aisle, no music. The crowd is going nuts, and there's a guy holding up a sign into the aisle that says, "Where's Doink?"
Was that you, Rich?
I wish it was.
That's amazing. That's bad timing.
There's this line that he delivers, and is like, "My son can't go out in the sunshine because it hurts his scars so bad." And like, for some reason, that cracked me up so hard.
Oh, man.
I had to pause it and like recontain myself. I don't know why Paul Bearer is saying, "My boy can't go in the sunshine." This like rattled me somehow.
I damned you to hell.
He's changed his voice a little bit at this point too. It's not just like creepy shrill, it's like southern shrill, angry, high pitched kind of thing.
That's how much pain he was in. It made him change his accent.
Yeah. And And he lands an incredible last line to in this promo. He says, "You can laugh at the fat man all you want, because I'll be laughing all the way to the bank." So good.
It's really good. Yeah, he talks about Kane growing up alone in that house and just watching his brother on TV and asking his dad when he can go out and yeah, no, it's a tour de force.
Yeah, and then they just kind of wrap it up with some canned late 90s and commercial rock segue music.
Yeah, weird.
Like, well, ladies and gentlemen, that was Paul Bearer. Boom, 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 like. Okay.
This is the Seinfeld intro. Yeah. Anyway, yeah, it's great. I'd watch that again over half of the movies that were nominated for Oscars this year. So you mentioned the NWA invasion angle, so I think we've got a piece of that here, right?
We do.
It's the New Age Outlaws. This is the Road Dogg and Billy Gunn, who looks fucking identical. It's insane versus the Midnight Express. Now this is not the classic Midnight Express, of course. This is Bodacious Bart, who is formerly Bart Gunn. He was in the Smoking Guns
with Billy Gunn.
Billy and Bart. And his partner is Bombastic Bob, who is Bob Holly, who is going on his like 400th gimmick at this point. They are managed by the inimitable Jim Cornette, of course.
The odd thing is that Bob and Bart are a good tag team together. They work well together. They were just cursed by being called the New Midnight Express, because at this point, no one knew who the fuck the Midnight Express were. No one gave a shit, because any remnants of the Midnight Express are over in WCW or retired sitting at home. The WWF crowd has no clue who the hell these guys are, and they don't care. They have seen them. So that you see that they are sporting the NWA World Tag Championship. And so I did some digging. I was like, boy, this looks fake. And so the thing is that the NWA actually didn't have a full World Tag Championship until 1992. Right, all the other world tag championships in the NWA were territory and regional specific. There was no, so like how Ric Flair was the NWA world champion and he went and took that belt to all the territories and stuff. They did not have that for tag teams.
Yeah, fascinating.
Until 1992, but at 1992, you know, it's too and late. So. It was the WCW Tag Championship at that point. So they were coincided, but then WCW pulled out of the NWA in 1993, and so the titles were vacated, but the Rock and Roll Express were still bouncing around in the USWA, and the Smoky Mountain Wrestling that Jim Cornette ran. And so the NWA gave them the titles. And then they showed up on Monday Night Raw, the Rock and Roll Express, and they lost the titles to the Headbangers on WWF TV. And then the Headbangers lost those titles to the New Midnight Express in this part of this failed NWA invasion storyline cooked up by Jim Cornette. There was Dan Severn was part of it. Jeff Jarrett was part. And obviously, the New Midnight Express were also part of it. Yeah, it's a weird little storyline.
That's bizarre.
Everybody has forgotten about.
That sounds like a title history from like an alternate universe. You know?
Yeah.
Anyway. I agree with you. These guys actually work really well together. Bob Holly has this magnificent blonde mullet. Bart Gunn is a big dude or two big strong dudes. You know, of course, Billy Gunn and Road Dogg really got it going on. This is actually a fun match. There's a lot of tough physical action here.
Yeah.
Just really classic tag team wrestling. Relatively, you know, there's a couple of suck it things, but it's relatively like by the numbers, tag team stuff. I didn't feel like it was way out of whack or, you know what I mean?
Like, yeah, the Road Dogg and Billy Gunn, they work well together. The New Midnight Express work well together, and these two teams look good together. But no one gave a shit about this match.
Yeah, there's no like reason for it to be happening.
Right. And I feel like people forget that the Road Dogg and Billy Gunn were also part of DX.
I don't forget that.
I know. I just feel like everybody just thinks DX was like China, Shawn, and Triple H, and then X-Pac. But like Road Dogg and Billy Gunn were lined up with them too. So because of that, we've now heard the DX theme like 15 fucking times on the show. It is a lot.
Yeah. It's not over yet.
No. And there is another brilliant sign that gets some camera time in this match, and that says Bischoff and Turner need their asses wiped.
I don't know what that means.
I don't know either. Don't know.
Cornette interferes with the tennis rackets here, but the ref is distracted long enough for Billy to kick out when he finally gets back around to pin. Then China comes in and nutshots Cornette, so the New Age Outlaws get this one. Yeah, I mean, I always kind of thought of DX as sort of like a modern take on the Horsemen, right? You've got Tully and Arn, who are your tag team guys, and then you've got like your sort of enforcer guy, and then you've got your leader, right? So
yeah.
China was the enforcer, Triple H or Shawn at various points were the leader. The only person that doesn't really fit is X-Pac. There's like one too many people. Anyway, all right, maybe that's not a great analogy.
It actually is a pretty decent kind of thing, because I mean, that's what all the solid stables are. Like, you had your top singles guy, and then they had a tag team in it that was like a natural tag team together. And, you know, some floaters.
Supporting ones, yeah.
Yeah. Enough bodies to where, like, even if there's, like, a 4-on-4 match, you got someone extra that can kick in and interfere or something like that. So,
anyway, that was fun. Nice little surprise. Yeah. Ken Shamrock and The Rock are up for the King of the Ring finale.
Oh, yeah, there's a tournament happening on this show.
Yeah, I kind of forgot. Triple H and China get the full entrance with the music. Just so that he can come and do color commentary. I wrote down he looks like an old man trying to be a young punk. And it's kind of embarrassing in retrospect.
And there's a lot of xenophobia coming out of him about the Spanish announce table. Which, impressively, China is at the Spanish announce table during this and speaking fluent Spanish with the Spanish crew.
Who knew?
It's impressive. It is impressive. It's incredible. Yeah. Triple H is also taking pot shots at WCW in the commentary during this. He says that this match isn't just some old men stumbling around the ring.
Ouch.
Yeah.
That's not very nice.
And I also think Triple H said, it might have been, I think it was Triple H that said this during the commentary of this too, that he said, better to be a coward for a minute than dead for the rest of your life.
That's not how that saying goes. But that's okay. What would Braveheart say? I don't know. That's Ken Shamrock. I just, you know, he looks like he means it always.
Yeah.
He's never less than 110% committed. He's stupid strong. He power slams The Rock and then German suplexes him despite being like a foot height difference between the two of them.
Yeah. He throws The Rock around.
He just manhandles him. He rock handles him, you could say. The story that they're kind of telling here is that both of these guys are ready to go to the absolute limit to get the win if that's what it takes. And they're beating the holy snot out of each other and they're wearing each other down bit in a bit. The Rock, I'd say, is overselling a little bit throughout here, but that's also kind of his deal.
I thought it was bold of them to just have Shamrock win straight clean. Just locks in his ankle lock on The Rock, and The Rock taps out. Shamrock was taking that foot home with him as a souvenir. Shamrock at this point was set to be the next big man, and they were ready to make him a run and probably put the title on him by the next WrestleMania at this point. But Shamrock missed a booking, like completely no-showed a house show in El Paso, and then was also having some drug issues, and they got him clean. He came back and he worked some more, but he then felt that he needed to go back to UFC, that he wasn't done. And that was partially because he could just do one fight in UFC and make a ton of money, or have to work 300 nights a year and not make quite as much money.
Yeah, that's not a bad trade.
Right. And so he chose to go back to UFC instead of taking this push that they were about to send him skyrocketing on, and basically The Rock takes his place in that.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I mean, at that time, I think the guys seem to work a little more frequently now, but, like, the top guys in UFC would probably work, what, 3 big fights a year?
Maybe.
Maybe?
Maybe.
Yeah.
They weren't doing monthly pay-per-views yet at that point.
No. And you just train the rest of the time. Just
right.
Be a maniac. Yeah, he could have taken that foot along with him. He probably could have gotten it through through airport security. This is pre-9/11, so, you know. There is a sign alert here that says Shamrock, the real rock, which I liked. I thought that was poetic.
Yeah.
He's not a Shamrock. That's the other rock is the sham. If he's the real rock, that means the rock is the Shamrock.
Shamrock.
I just got that. I just made that up. All right. All right. Nice video package for Mankind and Undertaker to set up this next thing. Deep breaths. Everybody get a pee break. Go crack open the next beer if you need it. This is the one. This is the Hell in a Cell match between the Mankind, good old Mick Foley, and the Undertaker. JR tells us that the cell is custom built for injury. It's a giant steel cyclone fence cage with a roof on it. It sits down over top of the ring. There's not a whole lot of room around the sides.
Yeah. And of course, there's fascinating history about this match.
Yeah, lay it on
me. Well, the lead into this match, initially creative said this was going to be Mankind versus Stone Cold in this match. And this is, while they say in the show that this is the second Hell in a Cell match, but this is actually the third. The first one was the incredible one between Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker at the In Your House. And then there was this 2 weeks before this event, on Monday Night Raw, they had a tornado tag match with Undertaker and Stone Cold versus Mankind and Kane in a Hell in a Cell, and then this match. And so initially, this was supposed to be Stone Cold and Mankind, but Vince Russo thought that that wasn't the proper booking. And so he called Mick Foley and told him that, you know, you're no longer going to be working with Stone Cold at King of the Ring. And Mick was like, oh, this is it for me. They're burying me. I'm gone. And then he's like, so I'm out of the cage. And he's like, I wouldn't say that yet. And then it came back to him about a week later. They're like, you're going to be fighting The Undertaker in the cage. And he's like, oh, shit.
You're going to fight The Undertaker, player?
Right.
We're not at that part yet.
No. Mankind sits down and watches the Shawn Michaels versus Undertaker match, which is a classic Hell in a Cell match, but it's very straight, and Mankind is very concerned because he's like, I can't work like Shawn Michaels does. I can't fly. I can't, you know, I can take,
wait a minute. Yeah.
I know I can't take punishment. And so all I can do is take these hits and bumps, and I'm willing to do horrible things to my body. So he comes up with this idea after watching the match like 20 times to the moment I come out to the ring, I'm going to climb the cage. I'm going to climb to the top of this thing. No one has done that. And apparently every week for like 3 months while this had been planned, he was going up to the Undertaker and going, How about we start at the top of the ring? How about we start at the top of the cage? And Undertaker's like, no.
I've heard that before. And I heard that he also had to, like, poke and prod the Undertaker into tossing him off, right? Like,
yeah.
Sorry, I don't want to step on your story. Go ahead.
No. That's exactly right. Undertaker's like, I can't do that to you. I can't do that. The thing is that they kept it to themselves that they were going to do that too. They didn't. Jim Ross did not know. Jim Ross had heard rumors of the boys talking in the locker room that he was going to throw Mankind off the top of the cage. And he was like, no, that's not real. There's no way they're doing
that. There's no way.
And you can tell that, like, no one was prepared for it because, like, the Spanish announce table doesn't evacuate. The table is not gimmicked, and so you can see the table brads, the sharp pointy ends of the table brads sticking out. It's a miracle he doesn't get stabbed. But let's not spoil any more of this.
So Mick comes out first. He's carrying a chair, right? And he starts by climbing the cage. I just wrote, this is not a well man. And then, of course, The Undertaker comes out and has to follow him up the side of the cage. And they get right to it. And, you know, in my mind, this match goes on a lot longer before that moment. But they're really oh, only no. up there, I'd say, less than 2 minutes.
Yeah.
They exchange a couple of shots. Mick kind of teeters on the edge. And you can see them both almost sort of like, this is happening.
Here we go.
And then off he goes, and he tosses him right the fuck off the cage. And it is, you know, it is one of, you've seen it, we've all seen it. It's hard to oversell it, honestly. It gets shared constantly. But, you know, I think what really makes it is JR's call. It's, you know, it's just such a classic. He's and you could tell he had no fucking idea this was going to happen, right? Like, there's kayfabe, and then there is JR saying, "As God is my witness, he is broken in half."
Yeah. Get a goddamn doctor out here. Get a
goddamn doctor out here. And it's just fucking chaos. Like, the whole thing just breaks down into chaos. And you could tell The Undertaker is sort of like watching, kind of like peeking out over the edge to see, you know, oh shit, did I kill him? Mankind is laid out face down on the floor and doesn't move for an uncomfortably long time.
This moment also shares one of the most incredible fan call-outs during a moment of quiet. So the crowd is pretty quiet while Mankind climbs up to the top and is rustling around before the Undertaker's music hits. And you can hear a fan scream out, "Don't fall on me!" It is so incredible. It's like there's a psychic in the crowd. Like,
are we sure that wasn't Carlos Cabrera saying that?
It's very possible. The terrifying thing about this, if you listen to this match with the volume up, I'm a sound guy. I need to hear everything. So you hear the guy scream, "Don't fall on me." But then while they're up there, you can start hearing the ties that hold the roof to the support beams popping. It sounds like little ping, ping, pop, ping, pop. You can hear them every step that those two guys are taking on the top of that thing. And they're both over 300 pounds. So, and because they never even fathomed that the wrestlers would go on top of the Hell in a Cell, they never took much care in putting together the roof of the thing. And so that is, so it's basically just like wire ties and little aluminum twisties that are holding the roof of the thing on.
Yeah, it's decorative.
And yeah, the roof is supposed to be decorative on this thing. Like, it's just a cage match, but the cage is closed in.
Yeah.
And so that's the whole concept of it. But, like, well, these two jackasses decide to climb to the top of it and test its structural integrity, and boy, do we lose. We find out that it doesn't work.
It doesn't work. So JR just keeps saying, "This is over. This is over." He thinks this is done. Like, this is it. And, you know, again, if you're watching it in real time, you don't know where this is going. You're like, yeah, this match is over. Like, that guy is just about fucking dead. They show, I counted the replays, and they show it another four times. You get it twice from the original angle, from looking sort of on level with the guys, right? And then you get it once from below, which is just fucking horrific.
Yeah.
And then you get it once from above, which somehow manages to look even worse. And every single time, the thud on that table is sickening. You know, it's not like a little crunch. It is like 300 pounds of meat hitting a solid surface that doesn't immediately fold.
Oh, my God.
His head misses the steel security rail by maybe 2 inches. And it is horrifying to watch. I literally wrote in my notes, "Jesus Christ, there it is." You can't prepare yourself to see it. The thing is, too, is that after you see it, wrestling is different.
100%.
It is all different. It JR is angrily calling for people to come. And this is how hardcore the crowd is with this. One, they're cheering like crazy. I mean, I probably would be too. I just saw a man
get
thrown 16 feet. If you have a hard time picturing 16 feet, watch this and see how far mankind falls. And that is 16 feet. But Terry Funk is like the first person to come running down ringside to check on Mankind. And JR is still keeping the kayfabe up. You know, those two men have had their disagreements in the past and they're at it. But, you know, there's still humanity. You still have to, like, it's this beautiful play calling by Jim Ross. And you can hear a fan yelling, "Good to see you, Terry. It's good to see you." Like, he's trying to make sure the dude's not dead.
Yeah.
And then another guy, after the "good to see you, Terry," screams, "Finish the match, Mick. Come on."
Yeah, it's crazy. And it's, you know, so Terry and Mick were sort of in a, they had a kind of long running thing where they were like feuding with each other, you know, because they were both like the hardcore guys. And they sort of mentioned it on the commentary, like, "Oh, he's putting aside his differences to come out here."
Yeah.
And he's not dressed. Like, he's not there to wrestle. He's dressed like your grandpa going to the golf course or the American Legion. He's wearing sweatpants. He's wearing his, like, white New Balance and, like, a very oversized ball cap. Sergeant Slaughter and Vince come out to check on Mick. They have to raise the cage so that the EMTs can get the stretcher around it. I'm just like, why are they raising the cage? And Undertaker's standing up there looking very uncomfortable, and you realize they physically can't get the stretcher to him. So
Undertaker's now like, is this cage going to keep supporting me?
Yeah.
And now am I going to fall through it and drop like 25 feet because they've raised the cage?
Onto my broken fucking ankle, yeah.
Right.
So they get Mick up the ramp, and you're like, well, that was horrific, but at least it's over. And then this motherfucker turns around and starts his way back down the ramp. And the guys are legitimately trying to tell him not to do this. Like, it's not like a work, like, "Oh, no, hold me back, hold me back." They're like, "Motherfucker, your shoulder is not attached to the socket at the moment." Like, he's holding his arm across his body kind of awkwardly. He doesn't look all there. His eyes have a kind of a glassy thing. I just wrote, my stomach literally drops when he comes back out clutching his shoulder. And again, I've seen this roughly 200 times. Like, I've seen this more often than I've seen, like, photos of my wedding. And I was still, like, shocked and horrified that he is coming back out to take another round.
And the thing is, after that, he doesn't just come back to the ring. He climbs the fucking cage again with a detached shoulder. He's climbing the cage to get back at the Undertaker. And so motherfuckers get back up there and you start hearing the ping, ping, ping. And Undertaker choke slams him. And unplanned, Mankind goes through the roof of the cell and smacks flat on his back onto the ring.
Amazing here. Oh, a headbutt by the Undertaker and a right hand. Now if he throws him off on the other side, there's... Good God! Good God! That's it, he's dead.
Jim Ross talks about that this is still the old model WWF ring that is still built super strong and tough and stiff to handle the big guys like King Kong Bundy, Andre the Giant, Hulk Hogan, to handle their weight in the ring. And they hadn't changed the ring to be softer yet to handle the more lighter weight guys. And so when JR says that ring is like concrete, he's not lying.
Yeah. Cornette regularly talks about how hard the WWF rings were compared to even some of the ones in the territories and stuff. Yeah,
they changed the ring after this. They changed the ring. They were like, well, shit. We need to change the ring. That nearly killed a man.
Man.
And so Mick is actually talks about how he's angry at himself because it was the worst sold choke slam that he ever did because he mistimed the jump. But then he's like, if I would have actually done it properly, I would have continued rotating through the cage and landed on my damn head instead of landing flat on his back. He probably would have died, if not paralyzed.
It's crazy.
And so him botching the bump saved his life, you know.
Well, so again, the Undertaker is kind of peering through the hole in the cage that he just created with Mick's prone, lifeless body. And he can, again, you can kind of see him with a holy shit, like, look of concern on his face. And then he goes to kind of drop down through the door to the floor of the cage. And the guys are, the refs and the other guys waiting on Mick are sort of like waving him off as if he were going to like drop a flying elbow on him or something from the cage. Like, it's almost like no more moves. Like, he's just literally trying to get down so he doesn't get killed. And then Terry Funk, in what has to be a sort of an unplanned moment of sort of improv, comes in and sort of like fills in so Mick can just gain consciousness again and kind of like, you know, pushes the Undertaker around a little bit. And then he gets choke slammed. It's a very awkward choke slam. It's clearly Terry hasn't, you know, maybe hasn't taken that from the Undertaker before.
He's that also is trying exactly to, what is happening. Is you that can tell. Mankind can is, tell. Is unconscious, and Terry is trying to buy him time. And so Terry engages with the Undertaker to try and give Mankind some time to get himself back together. As much as you can get back together after falling 16 feet from top of a cage through a table and then getting up and getting slammed through the roof of the cage to the ring, which was probably another 12-foot drop.
And being completely and totally unconscious.
Right. Now everyone is bleeding.
Yep.
And Mick gets back up and he actually mounts some offense.
He does.
He mounts offense, people. He has fallen a total of probably 30 feet between two drops, and he mounts offense and gets some good shots in on the Undertaker, and the Undertaker is bleeding, and now he's bleeding, and Mick Foley pulls out a bag of goddamn thumbtacks.
So two things before the thumbtacks. One is Jim Ross, who, again, deserves to be... have a bronze statue in the Announcers Hall of Fame somewhere, from all sports of all time, for the call on this particular match. He says, "These men are in hell, and hell is in Pittsburgh."
Yes.
I can relate to that. Undertaker's bleeding. Mankind gives him a pile driver on a chair and then puts a chair across the Undertaker's face and leg drops it. And that's when Undertaker starts bleeding. And I noticed that during this whole offensive thing, Mankind is like, it's grunting like an animal. He's like grunting and sort of making these like squealing sounds, like a wounded animal, like turning on a hunter, you know, at the end of the trail, you know. And it's, I don't know if it's intentional, if he was just in so much actual pain, but I have to...
It was always part of his gimmick, of that gimmick, to do that. Now, at this point, also, Mankind sits himself in the corner, and the camera gets a good close-up, and you can see a hole in his lower lip that his tongue is big enough to fit through. He's bleeding from the mouth, and he has a tooth coming out of his nose.
Say that again for the people at the back.
So he has a hole in the bottom of his lip. His mouth is bleeding, full of blood, and he has a tooth coming out of his nose.
Yeah.
And he's smiling.
Yeah. It's crazy. Motherfucker swallowed or knocked out a tooth, aspirated it, and blew it up its nose.
And he's happy.
And he's happy about it. He looks like a pig in shit. He looks like, looks like a kid at the beach. So if you didn't watch Japanese deathmatch horseshit before 1998, would this have been sort of the first exposure to the thumbtacks?
Oh, for me, it was totally. Yeah. I mean, my thoughts on this match, I have a lot. That one, it is possibly the greatest cage match ever. It is possibly one of the best wrestling matches ever. It is pornography. It is straight up porn. You watch it, you're never the same after it. And
it borders on indecent. Yeah.
You climax before it climaxes. And then watching it, continuing to watch it after Mick takes that initial bump from the roof is just pure like hatred of yourself and hatred of humanity. And you just, you feel horrible, but you can't look away.
Yeah.
You can't stop watching it because it is so goddamn engaging. And it's insane. You can't believe what you're watching.
Yeah.
And you're sitting there like, this is pro wrestling, you know. But that dude just fell 16 feet, and that was completely real. And then he fell another 12 feet, and that was real. I can see that his tooth is coming out of his nose, and his shoulders don't line up anymore. So it hell has to be real. He's got thumbtacks coming out of his face. I don't, like,
yeah.
This is gross and disturbing, and I have to keep watching. I would go as far as saying that because of this match is the reason why a year later, when Owen tragically falls to his death, the WWF doesn't stop the show.
Yeah.
Because the crowd is kind of desensitized and they can't tell exactly what has just happened. Yeah, Owen just fell from the arena ceiling, but, you know, they put him on a stretcher, they took him out, I'm sure he's fine. Let's keep going. And I'm sure it's partially because this match takes the line and erases it, moves it back, and then steps over it again. Like, it just keeps, it doesn't stop.
Yeah.
And this is happening on a Sunday night. It's like, no wonder people tuned in Monday night. Like, they got to make sure Mankind's not dead. That Monday Night Raw on June 22nd, so the Raw before had a 4.3, the Raw after had a 5.4. So this match got its ratings, and this match lives in infamy now. Yeah. We haven't even talked about the finish of this match.
Yeah.
So Mick, we haven't, that, like, Undertaker then picks up Mick Foley, pile drives him on the thumbtacks and gets the win. And poor Mike Chioda has to sit there and slap the mat with the thumbtacks.
The one that, kills me is the three count. And then Mick kicks his left leg, like, just a little bit after that last three. Like, you haven't beaten me. He's still
fighting.
You haven't beaten me yet, you son of a bitch. Like, it's hopeless, but he still kicks it. It's brilliant, and it's moving, and it's terrifying, and it's an all-timer. It's in the top three.
And so they bring the stretcher back out to take Foley to the back, and apparently Foley asks, have I been on a stretcher already once tonight? And they tell him, yeah, Mick. He's like, I can't go out on a stretcher twice in one night. And so he convinces Slaughter and Terry Guerrera to help him to the back, walking.
It's crazy. Well, and he's talked about he doesn't have memories of big chunks of that match. No,
he doesn't remember falling from the top of the cage. He remembers, like, climbing back up. And then he doesn't really remember anything till the finish. I don't know.
It's almost a shame to move on. But if we don't, I feel like we're going to be here all night. But this is, it's your best match. It's your worst match. It's your oh shit moment. It's everything all in one.
For the whole year. For the entire run of the Attitude Era.
Yeah.
This is the pinnacle.
Hugely influential, obviously. And then I think, you know, to an extent, there was sort of a, an aesthetic of, like, sort of always upping the ante, right? And, like, and the deathmatch thing had been around, and the people breaking light tubes and all that horseshit and the thumbtacks and that stuff. But I think some people saw this and they're like, well, that's what wrestling is. Wrestling is hurting yourself in severe ways in front of people for their entertainment, which is the wrong message to take from this, right? Like, what he did was out of the ordinary and really fucking dumb, like, to be honest. You know, like, he did it because he is who he is, right? And, like, I think out of 10 guys who did either one of those spots, 8 of them wouldn't be walking anymore. And Mick Foley and maybe one other guy with his genetics could have, like, survived that.
Shortly after this, Rikishi and Undertaker reenact the moment, basically. But Rikishi falls into the back of a truck filled with hay, which is still dangerous as hell, but, I mean, it's not a hard table to a concrete floor. Because that's the other thing, is that they're in the igloo in Pittsburgh, the old arena in Pittsburgh, and that floor is hockey ice.
Yeah.
and then plywood, and then like a protective rug that, I mean, it's really more just like a protective fabric that all, everything sits on top of, and then the table. So he, Mick Foley went through the table. The table turns inside out, basically, when he hits it, lands on top of him, and then he still smacks into ice, basically. Yeah. Plywood and ice. That's what he hits. There's no mats.
No.
There's nothing cushioning that fall.
So here's my question. Does anybody who's familiar with this remember that that is not the main event on this card? I certainly didn't. Can you imagine being Stone Cold or Kane and having to follow that shit?
Not just follow it, but with the stupidest
first
concept.
Blood, yeah. So they're going to come out.
It's a first blood match.
Going to come out and have a first blood match after a guy's tooth literally came out of his nose in the previous match.
Yeah. And it's a first blood match. It's a first blood match, and it's multiple reasons why it's stupid. One, Kane covers every single piece of his body, including his face, with a mask and fabric. He is in a full bodysuit. If he's bleeding, you're not going to know it. Second, there's still thumbtacks everywhere. In 30 seconds into this match, Austin is bleeding because of the thumbtacks, and JR has to go, well, that blood wasn't caused by Kane, so it doesn't count. Earl Hebner's letting this one go because that blood wasn't caused by contact with Kane.
Like, yeah. He's got a pretty serious cut on his back. Like it's not just a little scrape. Like, he's bleeding, like, actually sort of fairly copiously from his back relatively quickly. Yeah,
probably because he downed a bottle of aspirin before the match, too, so that he would bleed like a horrible for it.
Yeah, JR says that a little scrape or a bloody nose won't cut it. You'll have to be busted open for this to count as first blood, which that's not what the rules say. But hey, so the promo to this is super intense. Lots of blood and fire. Kane vows to set himself on fire if he loses, which, I mean, go ahead. Do you? Seems a little...
And for some reason, the cell starts coming down during the match. And then it starts going back up, and then it comes back down. Like, it doesn't seem intentional, but then it kind of does, and then it's not, and they work well with it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it just seems like, why, let's just go home.
So they go at it for a little while, and then lo and behold, here comes Mankind.
Holy shit!
Just because he's a glutton for punishment, I guess he's here. Who's he here to help? Actually, I didn't.
He's coming down to help Kane,
right? Because he is also a freak who lives in a boiler room or whatever. I don't know.
Right.
And then he gets a stunner. Kane gets a stunner, and then the Undertaker comes down with a chair. By this point, he's limping pretty severely. Actually,
yeah,
his ankle has to be screaming. Mick ducks and Austin and Kane fence with. Mick ducks and. My words are
not. I know. What does it matter?
Undertaker and Austin fence with the chairs. And then, you know, Kane and Mankind both get wiped out, and the Undertaker tosses a ref inside. Austin is busted open. Lays out Kane with the chair, and I don't know what he's thinking. He's won, but he's like covered in blood, and the ref wakes up and sees that he's bloody, and he's like, oh, okay, well, that's the end of that.
Well, I mean, there's some other weird shit too. You can clearly see, Austin Blade himself. It's pretty freaking obvious. But Undertaker, for some reason, starts dousing Earl Hebner in gasoline.
Yeah, I didn't know what was going on there.
It's like, I mean, I know Mick has definitely suffered head trauma tonight. But did the Undertaker too? Then Austin hits Kane with a home run of a chair shot. Like, Jesus, he put him out in the Mahangaila. You know, Jesus Christ.
It gets a little bit chaotic, but Kane gets the win. He doesn't have to set himself on fire, which I guess is a plus. I don't know. At this point, would the crowd even have batted an eye if, like, a man immolated himself in the middle of the ring?
No.
Like, I'm like, well, that's nice. Let's beat the parking. Let's beat the parking rush. Get out of here. Yeah. So.
No.
And then we cut to Vince up in the box, and he's happy because Austin lost. That son of a bitch.
Lost the title to Kane.
Yep. And we can all go on about our lives. Then they roll the credits. It just ends.
Yeah.
Weird. Thoughts overall before we wrap this up? I mean, I don't know. I feel like I've been through the ringer. I told you this afternoon my chest kind of hurt after watching it.
Yeah.
And I feel like I'm not going to sleep very well tonight.
Until that Hell in a Cell match, you're angry that you paid money for this show. You're angry that you paid for basically what is a Monday Night Raw episode. Right? The King of the Ring has no sparkle to it. There's no coronation or anything like that to go with it. It's just like, well, Ken Shamrock is the King of the Ring. Next.
Thanks for coming.
Right. You know, this is the third match between The Rock and Ken Shamrock, and they were split 1-1, and that's Shamrock takes the third. And so, I mean, that was a real signifier that, like, Shamrock is about to get the push. But, you know, nothing on this card matters, you know, especially since Shamrock didn't get that push. The only thing that people really remember out of this is Mankind versus Undertaker and the first minute and a half of that match. It's hard to even call it a match.
Yeah.
There is some stuff eventually that resembles a wrestling match. You can see why in that match, why Ric Flair just called, you know, Mick Foley a glorified stuntman. He's not a wrestler. You can see why he would say something like that, especially in the heat of the Monday Night Wars. That's what it is. What's interesting to me is that Ric Flair loves Darby Allin, though. And Darby Allin screams the same kind of stuff. Anyways, I don't want to get off on a tangent here. We've already been going long enough, like Jesus.
Direct descendant of Mick Foley.
Yeah.
And of Mankind, so.
You can't talk about the Attitude Era of professional wrestling without talking about this match. You can't talk about cage matches without mentioning this match. This one's up there with Tully versus Magnum TA. You can't talk about anything.
You can't talk about anything that matters.
Anything in the hardcore genre.
You can't have a discussion of the careers and legacies of either of the men involved, for sure. You know, it's got to be on Jim Ross's top five calls of all time, whether he ranks it or not. It's up there because it's just so it's
Having met Mick Foley, it was really hard not to mention it to him. I literally said to him, I'm going to try not to mention you know what. And he says, yeah, I understand. I just literally said, I'm glad you're still here.
What a mensch. That guy he's such a good guy.
He is. And so I get it. Like, how could you throw someone that sweet and kind off a structure like that? But.
Alrighty. Well, I'm glad that we don't have to add Mick to this next section, but as we always do, we like to just take a moment to pay tribute to the men and women from the show, though, who are no longer with us. So our in memoriam section for King of the Ring 1998 from June 22nd, 1998. It's a relatively short one this time, but we have ring announcer Howard Finkel, Pat Patterson, referee Tim White, Brian Christopher of Too Much, Joni Lauer, a.k.a. China, Owen Hart, Vader, who we see in some of the flashback footage, Paul Bearer, a.k.a. Bill Moody, and, of course, the legendary Terry Funk. So, that's our show for today. We appreciate you listening. If you have a chance to go back and watch this one, send us your thoughts. Check us out on social media, Facebook and Instagram and TikTok and Twitter, X. You can find us at all the WrestleMania. No, not all the WrestleManias. That's our old show. You find us at
the owe me a dollar.
At thewrestlingarchives.com. You can also find us on protees.com/wrestlingarchives. And if you'd like
We're not on protees. Good God Lord.
Damn it. T Public.
TeePublic. There you go.
TeePublic. I knew that. We're on.
We're not cool enough for pro wrestling tees yet.
You can find us on teepublic.com/thewrestlingarchives. And if you'd like to support the show, you can go to ko-fi.com/thewrestlingarchives. Drop us $5, the cost of a coffee. Help us keep up our equipment and pay off our, our studio rent, but I'm recording this in my closet and Rich is in his basement, so we're good. But we appreciate you listening. We appreciate your support. So we're going to wrap up for this evening. I'm your co-host, Tim.
And I'm your co-host, Rich.
And we will see you next time. Don't fall off any cages, guys. Whew.